So, the song? Not a... There is a famous work among scholars of Indian literature called the Dwanya Loka by Ananda Vardhana. It was written perhaps 700 years, 800 years ago. And excuse me, in this book, Ananda Vardhana lays out formal sort of literary theory, which was extremely influential in Indian history among poets and writers and so on. And what's interesting about his book is that he gives as the best example of a perfect literature the Mahabharata. And he claims in his analysis of the Mahabharata that the prevailing... Oh, I am on your... But my feet also drink. Actually, in Sanskrit, one of the words for tree is padapa, foot drinker. Not a word for tree. But since I'm not a tree, I'll try that. Anyway, Ananda Vardhana, in analyzing the Mahabharata, talks about its rasa. And the word rasa literally means flavor, taste in Sanskrit, and it was used to mean the predominant emotion of a work, such as conjugal love or friendship or parental love or the love of a servant or a child for the master or parent. And so Ananda Vardhana says that in the Mahabharata, the ultimate emotion, interestingly enough, especially since we're about to describe an extremely violent set of events, is shanti. Shanti, or peace. And so, I will give some, or try to give some explanation of how we can think of the Mahabharata as a literature which ultimately teaches peace, although, of course, there's so much politics and violence and all that stuff. I said at the very beginning that the Mahabharata teaches us at three different levels. First, it's a story of a great dynastic struggle. It's part of the history of the world. And about human kings and princes and intrigue and so on. And secondly, it's a cosmic story because the great personalities in the Mahabharata, most of them actually came from other worlds, higher worlds. And ultimately, it's a spiritual narrative because within the Mahabharata is Bhagavad Gita, the great spiritual text of the Vedic culture. So, we've talked a lot about the politics and all that stuff and the fighting, and we've talked about the cosmic stuff, and we've mentioned sometimes the spiritual part, but to ultimately understand the Mahabharata and why, in 18 days, millions of warriors lost their lives, we have to keep in mind that the ultimate purpose of the Bhagavad Gita, the ultimate purpose of life, is not to enjoy this world, although certainly the Vedas teach that there is a way to be happy in this world and to live properly and so on, but ultimately to attain or to, say, rediscover our eternal nature. If you think of the word discover, which literally means to uncover, and that's Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita talks about the soul being covered or consciousness being covered. My teacher Prabhupada used to give the example that when a diamond falls into the mud, you pick it up and apparently you have a bunch of mud in your hand, but if you just wash off the diamond, it's still there. Compare this, for example, to pulverizing a diamond and flinging the powder into the ocean, and you know there's nothing to wipe off, it's gone. When Krishna compares matter and spirit, he talks about matter as something which is endlessly transformed and mutable. One thing changes into another. Whereas in the case of the soul or consciousness, spiritual consciousness, you never really lose yourself. You're always eternally intact. But consciousness becomes covered. And so to discover oneself is literally to remove that covering and to see who we really are. So, interestingly, the Mahabharata does not want to encourage you to remain in this world. If you consider that the text has two purposes, which are paradoxical but not contradictory. Paradox is an apparent contradiction which can be resolved. But still there's this tension. And the great Greek philosopher, I don't know how great he was, but he was pretty good. Herodotus, pre-Socratic philosopher, is famous for saying that if you consider a bow which has been strung, like a bow and arrows, it appears to be at rest, but actually the power of the bow comes from the tension between the two ends of the bow. So in the same way, there are tensions which are creative and powerful and which propel us forward. So the Mahabharata and all these great literatures have really two purposes. First of all, to attract us, because if we're not interested, no one's going to take the medicine. No one's going to derive any benefit from a book that they never read and never hear about. And so, first of all, there is a conscious attempt to draw you in. In fact, not only a conscious attempt in writing a book, but actually a conscious attempt in bringing certain activities to this world. As I've mentioned, the texts, Bhagavatam, Mahabharata, mention over and over again that Krishna is theatrical, that God is theatrical. He's like an actor. And he puts on a good show so that he can somehow draw us into these activities and engage us spiritually. So in the act of watching a good story or hearing a good story, we are actually practicing yoga and self-realization simply by hearing stories. And that was really the very conscious purpose, and the texts say this about themselves over and over again. So on the one hand, the purpose is to draw us in so that instead of busying ourselves with, mundane topics that don't really give us any spiritual benefit, we can satisfy our natural desire to hear good stories or watch movies, and at the same time progress in our self-realization. So that's one purpose. But on the other hand, there is the purpose to bring us up and out of material consciousness and ultimately to restore us in our eternal home beyond this world. So, and actually the Bhagavatam uses the word okus, home, and from the Sanskrit word okus, of course, we have the Greek word ekos, or the word ecology. Anyway, so here's a book which wants to interest you in what's going on in this world, but at the same time lift you out of this world. And so if we look at the Mahabharata, now the Pandavas are on the battlefield, Krishna, Arjuna loses his desire to fight, and a dialogue ensues in which Krishna first just tells Arjuna, what in the world are you doing? Because Krishna, he just says, this is crazy, Arjuna, what are you doing? And then when he sees that Arjuna is actually serious, then he says, okay, you need a little wisdom here. Then he teaches him Bhagavad Gita. After the Bhagavad Gita is over, or has been spoken, then the battle ensues. And we'll talk a little bit about that battle. But, so a few things. The purpose is to show you that even if you are an associate of Krishna, even if you have the supreme good fortune to actually travel to some universe, because it's described sort of as a traveling roadshow, that you can actually go to different universes and appear with great souls like Krishna or Shiva and so on, because they display these activities throughout the many universes. And so a purified soul has this option to actually accompany. You can become one of the Pandavas. You can become a participant in this story. So at the same time, the text wants to teach us that even if you get to participate in the story, ultimately this temporary world of samsara, as the Buddhists always point out, the world of suffering and birth and death and so on, is not our permanent home. And so this text wants to attract you and show you great things, but not in a way that sort of reinforces your desire to stay here. So, as far as the great personalities that took part in this battle, or took part in this entire story, the greatest of them were actually conscious of what they were doing. For example, let's say you could be in America or any other country, there's some type of danger or terrorist attack or whatever, something really bad is happening. The government will send all kinds of special forces perhaps to some little town, you know, some sleepy little town. Maybe it's got a post office and a, a yoga center. You know, some sleepy little town. And suddenly it's filled with thousands of soldiers and special forces and all kinds of things, helicopters and, you know, tanks, whatever, this sleepy little town. Now, as soon, and a battle may take place. If you look at the great battles of the world, they often took place in little towns that were insignificant. No one had ever heard of them. But that's where great battles took place, and millions of soldiers gathered. And so something, well, actually very much like that, this kind of sleepy backwater planet, you know, the Earth, became the focus of this cosmic battle. And as the Asuras were coming here, and so many devas, so many godly beings came here, and you could call it, it was sort of like a cosmic SWAT team. And so all these special forces came to the world, but once the battle was over and the danger was overcome, they couldn't stay there. I mean, what if, for example, in some little town where people live there and raise their families, and thousands of special forces come, then when the danger's over, they, well, maybe we'll just keep like 2,000 troops here on your main street, you know, some little town. No, it's like we want to go back to our normal life. We, you know, you've done your job, now go back to wherever you go when you've finished your job. So, in that way, the earth, in Krishna, this is actually a theme which you find in these great stories, and you find it Krishna himself saying that I came to this world to relieve the burden of the earth, but now my own devotees, my own associates, because they're so powerful, they're superhuman, if they remain here, they themselves will become the burden of the earth. And so that's a theme which comes up again and again. And therefore, in this battle, great souls like, let's say, Abhimanyu, or, I mean, so many soldiers on both sides, especially on the Pandava side, they understood that once our mission is done, we have to leave. In other words, die. It's not really death for someone who has their eyes open. It's simply, just like, for example, now we're in this pavilion, this hall, and when we leave here, we don't die. We just go down the sidewalk to another room. And so in the same way, for one who has their eyes open spiritually, leaving the body, I don't want to encourage suicide, by the way, but when our natural demise comes, it's just like changing rooms. Or to give the example that Krishna gives in the Gita, changing dress. Vasansi jirnani jitha vihaya, like giving up worn out clothes and taking new clothes. So many of the great souls who came understood that they would have to, that they had received special bodies for a special mission, and once that mission was over, they had to give back those bodies and go back where they came from. And so that's how the Mahabharata deals with these twin objectives, which are somewhat in tension with each other, the state of tension. That is to draw you in, to attract you, to get you into the story, and yet in doing so, not encourage you just to stay here forever in this world, but to go back to your real home, which is spiritual and eternal. So also on to the battle. That's a little bit of the background of what's going on here. And So, the battle started. The battle lasted 18 days, according to the text. And on the Pandava side, the general was Drishtadyumna, isn't it? Shankar? Pandava's general was Drishtadyumna. He was, no, someone had to manage the force, so Drishtadyumna was given that job. And on the Kuru side, the first general was Bhishma, their greatest warrior, the son of Ganga. So there are many battle stories, and Bhishma fought very valiantly, and often the Pandavas would all fight against him. He was simply unstoppable. But finally, there's one interesting story with Bhishma, which he himself talks about. In the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, chapter 9, there are really exquisite prayers offered by Bhishma just before he leaves this world, in which Krishna comes to him and he reveals himself to be really very devoted to Krishna. Shankar also, of course, wrote a very famous song to Krishna, isn't it? And anyway, Bhijma says, and this shows kind of like his own moral development or how his moral philosophy has changed a bit. Because remember, young Bhijma, it's like, I don't care about the consequences. I don't lie. I tell the truth. I keep my promise. I couldn't care, you know, whatever happens, not my problem. He doesn't care about consequences. But at the end of his life, Bhijma, and there's a part of the Mahabharata where Krishna personally teaches him that consequences matter. There's an interesting dialogue. Krishna had promised that he would not personally fight in the battle. He would simply be Arjuna's charioteer. Bhijma was determined to make Krishna break his promise. I mean, clearly this is a new version of Bhijma, in the sense that now, in other words, he wants to reveal Krishna's love for his devotee. And therefore, he wants to show that by attacking Arjuna, by really threatening Arjuna, when it finally comes down to it, Krishna will give up anything to save those who love him. And actually, Bhijma does show this, because he mounts this ferocious attack against Arjuna, and Arjuna's really in danger. And there's a very famous scene which is displayed in innumerable artworks in India for a very long time. Now, this is a battlefield, and so there's all kinds of, you know, chariot parts, because all kinds of chariots and weapons are being smashed. So the battlefield is just littered with this debris of fighting. And so when Krishna saw that Bhijma was really after Arjuna, he jumped off the chariot that he was driving, and he grabbed a chariot wheel that was lying there and just sort of transformed it into a chakra, you know, and on his finger. And he rushed at Bhijma. And Bhijma, in his prayer, said, "This is what I wanted to see." That, because everyone has their own unique relationship with God, and this is, of course, a very strong point in the teachings, that there are different ways to love God. Some people want God as their conjugal lover. You find this also in mystic Christianity, in bridal mysticism. You find it also in mystic forms of Judaism about 1,000 years ago in Spain. So this is one form of mystic devotion where in Christianity it's called bridal mysticism, where one sees the Lord as one's, in a sense, lover, and one sees oneself as the bride of God. And there's another relationship where you become God's parent, in the sense that, because if you think parents can't ever forget their children, although children do manage sometimes to forget their parents. And so if you develop this type of parental love for God, then you can never forget him for a moment. And so there's that Vatsalya Rasa, that parental love, and then there's friendship, like Arjuna with Krishna. Now Bhijma, because he was such a warrior, he longed to have this vision of Krishna coming at him with deadly force. Because he admired so much Krishna's chivalry, and he loved to see Krishna in that form. And Krishna would never do that because he was so respectful to Bhijma as a grandfather. So therefore, Bhijma provoked him and wanted to see Krishna that way, and wanted to show that Krishna would do anything to protect those who love him. So then, after that, Arjuna was saved. And finally, and I'm skipping some details which somehow are in the text, I mean, however they got there, but the basic point is that finally, Shikhandi, who had been Amba the past life, remember Amba, this tragic story of Amba, who was sent back and forth between these powerful men who would not believe her even when she was telling the truth, and they destroyed her life. And so finally, Amba, of course, has taken birth again as Shikhandi, this great warrior who finally kills Bhijma. And Bhijma must have known, he did know, that I destroyed this person's life. And there must have been, even in the moment of being slain by Shikhandi, Bhijma must have known the justice of it. That I ruined this person's life, I destroyed this person's life, and now there's justice. So, once Bhijma was gone, the next general was Drona. Drona took over, and this Brahmana, who had a real taste for violence and politics, so Drona took over as the commander, and he was also extremely difficult to fight. And finally, again skipping some details, it was Drishtadyumna who would kill him. And Drishtadyumna did kill him, actually. Drishtadyumna did kill him. Just one note to Shankar. If it had actually been the case, if just like he was defenseless like that, then, you know, anyone could have done it. He didn't need Drishtadyumna. Anyway, that's just a little shop talk, fellow scholar. So, once Drona was gone, then wasn't it Shalya?
No, it was Karna.
Before Shalya? No, Karna was Shalya's chariot driver. And that's where he fulfilled his, isn't it, promise to Kunti, I think, by kind of messing up Shalya.
Karna said the moment
Right, he stepped in, but I think Shalya was senior, and Karna was the chariot driver of Shalya, kind of. But he was back on the battlefield. Yeah, I mean, it's like Achilles. These stories reverberate throughout the world. For example, the Iliad by Homer, where Achilles says, "You will not fight as long as Agamemnon's on the battlefield," and the Greeks are losing. And so similarly, Karna said he would not fight as long as Bhishma was fighting because he felt that Bhishma had offended him. Another character trait of Karna, he felt he could be offended by someone so senior to him. Anyway, so then Shalya took over. This was the uncle of the Pandavas, who somehow was on the other side for various reasons, and he didn't last very long. Finally, Karna took over as the general, what he'd always been waiting for. And at this point, Karna knew that the Pandavas were his brothers. I didn't mention this before. But when Krishna was trying, again, people read the Bhagavad Gita and think Krishna is a hawk, you know, he just wants war. Actually, Krishna made many, many efforts. He tried everything possible, again, without interfering with the free will of other souls. Krishna tried everything possible to stop the war. And he even took Karna on his chariot and said, "Let's talk." And he told Karna, "You are actually the son of Kunti." And Kunti herself, you know, came just desperate to avoid this war. So the Pandavas, Krishna, all of them, Kunti, were doing everything possible to avoid the war. And Karna, he was moved. I mean, but he just... He said, I will not go back to my word. That I am sworn to fight with Duryodhana.
Promise not to kill any Pandavas.
Yes. Which is a little strange because his
promised to Kunti.
He promised Kunti that you still have five sons after, you know. However, it's sort of inexplicable why Karna, and no reason is ever given in the Mahabharata, actually, he had such hostility toward Arjuna. But in any case, finally, you know, like the supreme pay-per-view fight takes place. Karna and Arjuna. Now, again, some people have noticed that in the Mahabharata, which is a text which, according to great teachers like Madhvacharya, was influenced over time by different reciters and so on. But we have Karna, we have a Karna who's basically booby-trapped. I mean, he's completely like, got all these curses. He has so many curses that when he fights Arjuna, it turns out there's no real fight at all. Just all of his curses kind of kick in and he self-destructs. Personally, I don't think that's what really happened. I think there was actually a fight and Arjuna won. And the evidence for this is that they had encounters before. They met each other, although Karna didn't know who Arjuna was, at Draupadi Swayamvara, and Arjuna got the best of it. Yeah, exactly. I was going to mention that when Kichika, when Bhima, you know, beat Kichika to death, and then Duryodhana thought, "Now I can, you know, great, I can steal someone's kingdom." He went there, and then Arjuna, of course, just came out of exile, his incognito year, and he again defeated Karna. So, anyway, so Karna also died. And there are, so at that point, ultimately, when the battle was over, there were very few people left. The Pandavas were left. And then Ashwatthama, the son of Drona, committed what was considered then a heinous act. Even Duryodhana, who was still alive, although he was dying, considered it a heinous act. And that is, he killed the sleeping children of Draupadi, the five sons of Draupadi, and of course, just Jumna. And again, I think in order to understand all this, you have to understand the purpose of the Mahabharata is to draw you in, but not ultimately persuade you that your eternal home is inside of the material body and the material world, but that you have much, much better options waiting for you. You have your eternal life in a situation beyond your wildest dreams. So, therefore, this shanti, which Anandavardhana talks about, that ultimately these people, these special forces that came down to address a major threat to the universe, once the mission was accomplished, they had to go back. And so there's another, before I end this, there's a scene which I find very moving, and which involves Dushala, the sister of Duryodhana, who is actually a good person. After the war was over, of course, Yudhisthira was inconsolable. Yudhisthira was devastated because of all the destruction. And everyone tried to console him, great sages, even Krishna. But ultimately, the only person who could console him is Bhishma. There's a famous scene that when Drishtadyumna finally kills Bhishma, he shoots him so full of arrows that when Bhishma falls over on his back, he's literally on a bed of arrows. And this very famous story in India. And he's lying there, and he's thirsty, and it's Arjuna who understands his need. And so when once Bhishma is down, everyone comes forward because he's their grandfather. And Arjuna shoots an arrow into the ground, and water springs up, and he gives Bhishma a drink of natural spring water. And then Yudhisthira, because this is afterwards, in the Bhagavad Gita is explained that, I think I mentioned this already, that yogis who leave this world during the Dakshinayana, when the sun is traveling toward the south, obviously in the northern hemisphere, they come back. And yogis who leave this world when the sun is traveling to the north, they don't come back. And so the battle basically took place in November, perhaps early December, and Bhishma, who had the blessing of Chandamritu, could die at will whenever he wanted to die, he waited until the auspicious time when the sun had come out of the winter solstice and was heading back toward the north, and then he gave him his life. So therefore, after the battle was over, the Pandavas came to him to honor him and to receive wisdom from him before he left the world. And it was only Bhishma who could console Yudhisthira. It was actually Bhishma who finally convinced him, you have to give up this grief and rule the world. And so, so the Pandavas did that. And so the situation, what was the post-war situation on Earth? First of all, the world was in political chaos. That part of the world. Again, India was the center of that great landmass. There was simply political chaos. The Pandavas were officially now the rulers, but so many kings had been killed. Everyone's treasury had been exhausted. There was practically not, and they talk about this openly in the Mahabharata, there were not enough resources to govern. In other words, the government was bankrupt. And so I forget who was it, but someone revealed, some sage revealed, perhaps Vyasa, that there was once a king, ages ago. So for the Pandavas, this was very ancient history. Very, very ancient history. There had been a king who performed a sacrifice up in the Himalayan mountains. And in that age, in a previous yuga, which was even a greater yuga than the one the Pandavas appeared in, there was so much opulence in the world that that sacrifice, everything was made of gold. All of the utensils that people ate with, everything was made of gold. And there was a huge store of gold up in the mountains that had been forgotten. And so the Pandavas recovered that gold and used it to reestablish basically a central treasury to reestablish government in the world after the battle of Kurukshetra, and then to again establish political order in the world, Yudhishthira was going to perform the Ashwamedha sacrifice, similar to the Rajasuya, which again would establish him as a legitimate ruler. And so he sent his brothers in all directions, and the process was very simple, that in every kingdom, the local ruler, whoever was left, either in many cases, there were practically young boys ruling because their fathers were killed in the battle of Kurukshetra. So it was a very difficult time, and Yudhishthira gave special instructions to Arjun, who sent a challenge horse who could roam freely to every kingdom, and you had to either fight or accept the sovereignty of the Pandavas. It's interesting because Yudhishthira gave very explicit directions that people have had enough violence, I don't want more violence, that somehow or other persuade people to cooperate, because this is Dharma, the Pandavas ruling by Dharma, and if someone doesn't cooperate, use the minimum force necessary and do everything, and just somehow or other don't kill anyone. So Yudhishthira was very explicit on this point. He didn't want any more violence in the world. People need a break from all this. So Arjuna went following this horse, and this very moving incident took place in the kingdom of Sindh, which is a province now, I guess, the southern coast of Pakistan, the southern province of, now, the king of Sindh had been Jayadratha. This is a person who attempted to abduct Draupadi when she was with her. I mean, she was already married and just wanted to sort of steal her and enjoy her. And Draupadi whipped him with a chariot whip, and then the Pandavas caught up with him and beat him to within an inch of his life. And then there's a famous scene where Jayadratha helped the Kurus to kill Abhimanyu, and Arjun vowed to kill him, and did kill him. So, so when Arjun arrived in Sindh, this was the worst place, because the descendants of Jayadratha, his sons and grandsons, that were now in charge, were extremely bitter, and they practically all preferred to die rather than submit to the Pandavas. So when Arjuna came there, you know, he told them that you have these two options, and they made it very clear they would, you know, that they hated the Pandavas and they were going to fight. And Arjun said, you know, so Arjun was fighting with them. Arjun was a vastly superior warrior, and so he was just kind of fending them off because, you know, he kept saying, "Look, Yudhishthira told me not to kill you. Can't you just cooperate?" And they wouldn't. And finally, because they kept fighting, Yudhishthira said everything possible, but Arjun did that. They were still really attacking. And finally, Arjun said, "Okay, that's it." And so Arjun was really going to get serious about it now. And some people were going to have a reincarnation experience. But at that point, the widow of Jayadratha, who was actually a great lady, who had been humiliated by her husband when he tried to steal Draupadi, and who was actually a great lady, Dushala, the sister of Duryodhana and the wife of Jayadratha, this great lady simply walked out right into the middle of the battlefield. This was an active battlefield. She just walked right out into the battlefield. And as soon as she walked out, this queen mother, everyone just put down their weapons. I mean, obviously, she just ordered her grandchildren and their children to stop fighting, and of course, they obeyed her. And then she approached Arjun, who was ready to really start hurting people. And as soon as Arjun saw her, she was his cousin, like his sister. He immediately put down all his weapons and offered her respect. And she simply declared that the fight was over, and that the kingdom of Sin would in fact cooperate with the Pandavas. So it's a very moving, it's a very powerful story of how this great lady just ended a battle. Anyway, so interestingly, according to the Vaishnava tradition, in this age, after Krishna, as he said, reestablished Dharma, and in a sense, I think I said in the beginning, from the point of view of those for whom these things actually happen, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita that yada yada hi dharmas, whenever dharma is declining, so when I come, that the world is not worse than it is. Had Krishna not come, the world might be a very, very different place today. A much worse place. And so some things we take for granted, like, for example, that there's still some humans that aren't cannibals, or you know, you can still walk down the street in some place without being in serious fear of your life, that somehow or other dharma was reestablished. And interestingly, according to the tradition, when Krishna came again about 500 years ago as Chaitanya, there were no weapons. His weapons were just his associates who humbly tried to present his message to people. In fact, it's said that in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna asked everyone to just give up illusory activities and simply take shelter of the Lord. But because people couldn't understand it or somehow couldn't follow it, he came again to set the personal example as a devotee of Krishna, and no violence. Of course, I'm referring to Chaitanya Gauranga, about whom we sang. And interestingly, in the entire life of Gauranga, or Chaitanya, no one's ever killed not a single person. Although in Krishna Leela, of course, there was, you know, very big numbers up there. So, but in the past life of Chaitanya, not a single person was ever killed, or even really seriously injured. And in fact, it said that Chaitanya is Radha and Krishna together, so that in this age, because it's so fallen, that not only Krishna, but Radharani, the most compassionate form of the divine, also personally came within that same body, Radha and Krishna together, because only with such compassion can the people of this age be given a chance. So anyway, and what you're doing here, is the Yuga Dharma, something that always goes on, this ashram, chanting all these mantras, different names of God, and different names of the great souls who serve God. That is considered to be, in these literatures, the Yuga Dharma, the most powerful means in this age to awaken our eternal spiritual consciousness. So, anyway, thank you all again very much for your hospitality and your attention, and hope to see you all again soon.
Was it the Ganga that came out of the...